be big to be a story.
Right.
And, you know, so from a, you know, from a reporter's point of view, you know, all it takes is one person, you know, in the hospital with a weird, strange disease, you know, a protozoa that's 18 feet long, or a skin wasting disease that, you know, eats your skin, and it's like, oh wow, this is a great story. It's,
mm-hmm.
From a public health point of view, it's of negligible importance, but you know, you don't have to resort to a phrase like clickbait to know that it's good journalism. It's good journalism of a routine, you know, socially unimportant, maybe even socially misleading sort, but it's standard. Are you with me so far? Yeah, so it's like, it's no kind of surprise at all that reporters find rare but interesting diseases to be newsworthy. It's much more controversial when public health plays into that. And, you know, I mean, if you're calling public health and asking, what about that weird disease, I guess they have to answer you. But if they're calling you and saying, wow, do I have a great story for you, this really weird disease, I don't want to blame you for covering the story, but I blame them for calling you and making it a big deal when they know perfectly well it is.
Well, that's, yes. Well, I mean, people seem to be in the public health community making a very big deal of this vaping disease.
Yes. Yes. And then, so the question becomes, when is it good public health to make a big deal out of something that's statistically small? It's not affecting a lot of people. And there are a couple of answers. You know, the most obvious answer is if it's statistically small, but it might be about to get big.
Right.
Then, you know, then that's important. Then, you know, if it's the tip of the iceberg, and they're giving you and through you the society an early warning that this may turn out to be a big deal. That's good public health, and it stays good public health even if they turn out wrong. A few years back when there were warnings about bird flu that this disease that was common among birds and rare among humans, but extremely deadly to humans when it passed to them. As you know, there are lots of kinds of bird flus, but this particular bird flu was killing more than half the people who got it, and fortunately, very few people got it. But epidemiologists and virologists were staying up all night thinking, oh my God, if this virus learns how to transmit easily from one human to another, the 1918 flu pandemic killed, you know, between 2-3% of the people who got it. This kills over half the people who get it.
Mm-hmm.
So if it gets as easily communicated as that one was, while remaining as deadly as it already is, it'll be the worst pandemic ever. So they were warning people, and they managed to persuade high-level government officials that this was a big deal, and they managed to persuade a lot of journalists that this was a big deal. And at least so far, they turned out wrong. H5N1, which is the bird flu we're talking about, never acquired the ability to transmit easily from human to human. So it turned out never to be a big deal, so far anyway. So far it was wrong, but it was still good public health, and to warn you, and it was good journalism to cover the warning because it genuinely looked like it might be the tip of the iceberg.
And is that partly because we had the 1918 flu as a precedent, so we knew that a pandemic flu was possible?
That's certainly relevant. You know, I mean, we knew already that you know, a flu, a new species of flu is likely to go pandemic. If it transmits easily human to human, then no human's ever had it before, so nobody's immune and there's no vaccine. It's going to be a big deal. So it wasn't crazy to think this might be a big deal. Same thing with SARS, which turned out, you know, I mean, there was good reason to think SARS might be extremely important, and it turned out not to be extremely important. It was, you know, it was a big deal in the handful of cities where it circulated, but it turned out to be relatively easy, much easier than they feared, to stop with traditional epidemiological methods. So it, you know, yes, it was big in Singapore, and it was big in Hong Kong, and it was big in Beijing, and it was big in Toronto, but it was solved. You know, I mean, they fought it successfully. And SARS, you know, we don't know why SARS hasn't come back. It's still out there somewhere in the animal reservoir. It's out there in bats. But, you know, my point is, you know, when public health sees something small that might very well become big, it is their job to warn us. And whether they turn out right or they turn out wrong, the warning was smart. And the problem they have there is when they turn out wrong, there's a tendency to say they shouldn't have warned us. You know, with hindsight, with 2020 hindsight, we look and say, you know, what was all that BS about bird flu? It turned out to be nothing. And that's not fair. I mean, the warning was wise. So that's one paradigm where it's small now, it might very well get big. It might turn into something of public health importance. It's their job to warn us.
Okay.
The same is true if they think it might already be big but hidden, you know, and they're seeing it for the first time, but they're worrying that, you know, maybe there have been millions of cases and we missed them. We misdiagnosed them, or we didn't understand it, and now this new disease or newly appreciated disease is coming out of the woodwork, and it looks small so far, but we think that's because we missed all the historical cases. So that can happen. There are reasons why it makes sense to warn about something that is still small. That's the most obvious example.
Okay.
And then the more controversial one is where it's a genuinely small problem. They have no particular reason to think it's the tip of the iceberg. They have no particular reason to think that it's going to be a big deal. But it's a small problem that is a teachable moment for something they think is serious.
Okay.
You know, so they, you know, and that's controversial because, you know, because it's a teachable moment, they're pretending something small is big, so that they can make points on something they think matters.
What would be an example of that?
That's what they think they're doing with these cases of lung damage that they want to attribute to vaping. They start out thinking vaping is dangerous to young people, and we don't want all those young people to be addicted to nicotine for the rest of their lives. And we think, although the evidence isn't all that strong, that nicotine might be harmful, especially harmful to young brains. So the public health establishment in the U.S., although in the UK they've reached a different decision, so it's not obvious that they're right, but you know, the public health establishment in the US decided that vaping, especially vaping on the part of teenagers, is a serious public health problem. I think they're wrong, but you know, I'm kind of not entitled to an opinion. I don't have any of the relevant medical expertise. But they made that decision, and then these, you know, a few hundred lung illnesses materialize, and they say, oh, wow, what an opportunity to get reporters all over the country and government officials all over the country worried about vaping. And they know perfectly well that this is not a serious vaping problem, but they think vaping is a serious problem. So why don't we seize on this new, interesting, trivial vaping problem in order to make propaganda points against vaping, which we think is a big deal.
Okay.
And that's that's controversial. When I had clients that would want to make a big deal out of something little because it was a teachable moment for something they thought was big, you know, I would tend to say, all right, but tell the truth. I mean, then you can say, you know, this is a small reason not to do X, and there are a whole bunch of big reasons not to do X, and this is a reminder that X is awful, but this isn't the main reason X is awful. The main reason X is awful is A and B and C.
Okay.
And that would have been honest. And I think to make a big deal out of a small problem because it's a chance to score points against a behavior. It's like if people are getting sick and the illness is not very serious and the illness is not very common, but you want to say, here's a chance to teach people that they should wash their hands more often.
Right.
All right, I agree that you should wash your hands more often, but you shouldn't use a stupid reason for washing your hands more often as the thing you lean on to do propaganda for washing your hands. And in my judgment, at least, that's particularly dishonorable with regard to vaping. Already know that these lung diseases are predominantly people who smoke THCs, that is, smoke the active ingredient in marijuana. They already know it's people who are smoking either THC or bootleg flavorings. They're buying something on the street. They're buying or online. They're buying something that isn't the commercial vape product, and that's what's making them sick. In either all the cases or the vast majority of cases, they know it is not somebody buying a commercial vape product like, you know, Juul or one of the other big commercial products at a vape shop, bringing it home and using it fresh out of the package without doctoring it in any way. That is not what's making most people sick.
Okay.
So you have a problem that it's not only small, it's not about vaping, it's about vaping stuff you shouldn't be vaping. This is as if people were getting food poisoning, they had a few hundred cases of food poisoning, and they were saying, don't eat.
Right.
Until we figure out what's causing this food poisoning, and they were saying to themselves, well, you know, there's a lot of obesity, so don't eat is good public health.
Right.
And we'll just use the fact, you know, that we've got this newsworthy thing that is connected to vaping THC and vaping, food additives that aren't supposed to be inhaled. It's vaping the wrong stuff. And we'll just say it's vaping, because that's not quite a lie. You know, I mean, if we know it's eating salad, we can just say it's eating, and maybe we can get people to eat fewer Twinkies
by
saying, don't eat until we figure out whether it's salad or Twinkies, when they know damn well it's salad.
Yes.
I think that's dishonorable.
I like that analogy. But, you know, one thing that came up, I know you mentioned in your email that no one had really addressed this question of the public health warnings possibly pushing people to smoke cigarettes. And there actually was a story I found where young people were interviewed who said, well, you know, cigarettes I know will kill me, but not for a while, because lung cancer usually doesn't affect smokers until they're older, and this disease might kill me like now. You know, I'm only 20. I might switch to cigarettes. And your logic didn't seem crazy. I mean, that people are all going to die eventually, but people who are 20 don't want to die this year.
Yeah, we have no idea. I mean, you know, all niches are filled. There have got to be people who, as a result of this news story, are switching from vaping to smoking. Or people who were planning to switch from smoking to vaping and decided not to switch because they read that vaping kills you.
Right.
And there is survey research that indicates that a growing percentage of the population, both adults and teenagers, no longer believe that vaping is safer than smoking.
Right.
They have been convinced by public health that vaping is not safer than smoking, since almost all the evidence suggests that vaping is hugely safer than smoking. Public Health England says 95% safer, and that's just a guesstimate. But there's almost nobody that really doesn't think vaping is safer than smoking, assuming you're vaping something that's meant to be vaped.
I was getting at this question about that the one thing that makes the new disease scary, even though it's very rare, is that it seems to be indiscriminate about age, whereas lung cancer is an older person's disease. And so young people are saying, well, you know, even though this is really, really rare, I don't want to take any chances. I'm going to die like now. And that there is a difference between something that, you know, kills lots and lots of people, but doesn't kill young people, and something that might kill young people. So if a person is really just worried about dying in the near future, would it be crazy for them, if they're already addicted, to switch to cigarettes until we figure out what's going on with the vaping?
No, it's not crazy. I mean, it's not statistically sound, but, you know, we know that fear is very much influenced by memorability. In terms of language you and I have talked about before, memorability is one of the key outrage components.
Right.
And a way of dying that's memorable to you is going to arouse more fear and therefore more avoidant behavior than something less memorable. And obviously, you know, I'm a football player in good health. I'm looking forward to being on the varsity next year. And I read in the paper that some kid on the varsity now has the lungs of a 70-year-old because he vaped. And, you know, that's way scarier than that if I smoke, I might have the lungs of a 70-year-old when I'm 70.
Yeah.
At least I'll have my football trophies.
Right, right.
So absolutely predictable, not statistically reasonable, but humanly reasonable for a kid to say, you know, if it's going to give me lung cancer when I'm my parents' age, well, you know, I hope I'm never going to be that old anyway.
Okay. It also seems like, that we all, it would make sense if we were all immortal, but since we're all immortal, dying when you're 20 is worse than dying when you're 70. I mean,
to be perfectly candid, even public health people agree that dying when you're 20 is worse than dying when you're 60.
And when you're 20, you're well aware of that.
They measure mortality now increasingly in terms of years of life lost.
Right, right.
So
and that's why the new vaping
thing. A 20-year-old death, you know, even CDC would say a 20-year-old death is a more important death than a 60-year-old death.
Right, because more years are taken off of your life expectancy. It's more, you're losing more time. And
you're losing more, absolutely.
Yeah, and so that's where
I think a piece of this that's worth bearing in mind that's not directly connected to the lung damage, but it's connected to the messaging against vaping, and that's connected to the lung damage. The President Trump, the governor of New York, the governor of California, the legislature in Michigan, a whole lot of government officials at the state and national and local level have been provoked, at least in part by these lung injuries, to take steps against flavored e-cigs, which they imagine are mostly used by kids. And you may know the data that, you know, most people who vape prefer flavors other than tobacco flavor. That's true of adult vapers as well as teenage vapers. And they're taking steps to make vaping less attractive, essentially to everybody, by making vape flavors illegal.
Okay.
And if they make vape flavors illegal, there are only three things you can do if you want to vape. Either you're already a vapor, or you're a smoker who wants to become a vapor, or you're a non-smoker who wants to become a vapor, and they make the flavors illegal. There are only three options. Option one is, okay, so I'll abate this disgusting tobacco flavor. Option two is, I won't do anything. I'll live without this pleasure, And option three is I'll go to an alternative pleasure, either smoking, which is way more dangerous, or buying the vape that doesn't have the flavor I want and adding some kind of bootleg flavoring, which is way more dangerous. So, it's just an article of truth that anything you regulate, you create a black market. So if they make flavored vapes illegal, they're going to make both kids and adults who want to vape either go to illegal vapes, that is to say, flavorings that weren't meant to be added to e-cigs, or to smoking. So the huge paradox here is because of these lung diseases, they've decided they really need to push kids and grown-ups toward the things that are causing these lung diseases.
Ah, I see. Yeah, and it seems like there's a bit of denial that this is an addictive substance. You can't just tell people to stop using it. That people who use it are often very addicted, and therefore will gravitate towards something else, like cigarettes.
Yeah, if I'm addicted to nicotine and I'm getting it from commercial vapes, which is the safest way we know of to get it, and you make the commercial vapes less attractive by taking away my mango vape, and now all I can get is tobacco vape, either I go to smoking or I buy mango juice and try and inject it into my cartridge. I'm going to do something to meet my my nicotine need. I'm going to go from the safest way to meet my nicotine need to some less safe way to meet my nicotine need.
I see.
And to be sure, some people are going to quit. Some people are going to say, well, if I can't get mango vapes legally, I'll eat mangoes. I'll wean myself off of nicotine. So, they will get some of what they want, and they will get some of what they shouldn't want, and they don't seem to care.
Yeah, that is do you think that there's sort of a politically correct side to this, that people are sort of afraid to say that vaping is anything but evil, and that's sort of a politically correct view?
There is now, yeah. I mean, I think that certainly within public health, there are now public health people who know perfectly well that this is horrible public health, that harm reduction is a fundamental premise of public health. If you've got people who are using you've got heroin addicts who are reusing needles, you don't take the position that if they're heroin addicts, the hell with their health. You take the position that if we can get them to stop reusing needles, that's good for heroin addicts, and we will reduce the harm. Harm reduction is a fundamental premise of public health. There have got to be people in public health who know that e-cigs are a powerful tool of harm reduction, and making e-cigs less attractive is going to increase the harm done by nicotine. They've got to know that, and they don't dare say so.
Yeah. So I wonder.
I think in the leadership of public health, it can't be political correctness because they made it so. You should really spend some time, if you have a chance, looking at what public health is doing in the UK and in the United Kingdom, where they have decided, as a the whole guild, the whole public health establishment in the United Kingdom has decided that. That vaping is a powerful tool of harm reduction. And they have vape shops in hospitals so that they can encourage smokers to switch to vaping. It's not universal. And the, to me, the most fascinating question is, why did the public health establishment in the U.S., in the face of very good evidence, not you know, it's not like they might not be right, I mean, who knows, maybe 40 years from now we will realize that vaping is more dangerous than smoking, but all the available evidence so far suggests that vaping is way less dangerous than smoking and is a very good way to diminish the attractiveness of smoking, and it's already working, and smoking among teenagers is way down and vaping is way up, and those two things are causally connected. In the face of all of that evidence, why did the public health establishment in the United States decide to lead the charge against vaping? And that's an interesting question. And I don't know the answer, but I would suggest, two possible answers.
Okay.
One possible answer is just mission creep. Fighting smoking was getting boring. There are fewer and fewer smokers in the U.S. If you've devoted your life to being against smoking and now you're against something that everybody else is against too, maybe you're looking around for a new mission. In the same way that March of Dimes had to find new birth defects, maybe anti-smoking people sort of said, oh shit, being anti-smoking is no fun anymore. What's light smoking that we can expand our mission? And they decided to be anti-vaping. That's one possibility. The other possibility, which I think is likelier, is outrage. That for very good reasons they hate the tobacco industry. They have been fooled by the tobacco industry before. You go back in history and the tobacco industry convinced a lot of people that filters made smoking safe, and that was nonsense. They convinced a lot of people that light cigarettes made smoking safe, and it was a while before we all realized that, when you smoke light cigarettes, you breathe in harder until you get the same amount of nicotine, so that didn't do any good. And I think there's a sense that the tobacco industry is evil, the tobacco industry lies, and the worst thing that happened to public health was the tobacco industry bought into the vape industry. Altria now owns a major hunk of Juul. And, if instead of Altria buying Juul, Bloomberg had bought Juul, and Bloomberg was there saying, yes, I bought Juul because it is it's the crown jewel, no pun intended, of my anti-smoking campaign. Then I think we'd be in a much better place for public health. I think public health hates the tobacco industry, hates anything the tobacco industry touches. And since the tobacco industry is now heavily invested in e-cigs, that, I think, had a major impact on public health deciding that e-cigs are evil.
Do you think that there's any way to know also whether this new disease is a tip of the iceberg disease, or is there any way to sort of get a sense of whether it's likely to remain rare?
This is kind of outside my field. It's not a communication question, but all the experts that I respect are basically saying this has to be new. We can't possibly have missed it. There's been, a huge enough number of people vaping for enough years, and this isn't a chronic effect. This isn't something that happens after 20 years of vaping. The people getting it have been vaping for just a year or two. There are millions of people who have been vaping for a year or two. It's not a subtle health effect. We wouldn't have missed it. So I think the chances that this has been under the radar and it's been a big deal for years and we just found it are negligible.
I see,
So it's got to be new. If it's new, the only way it can be big is if something new and big is causing it. And I just, I don't know enough about the illicit vape market, you know? I mean, it's you know, you go back to Breaking Bad, right? You go back to Walter White. And, you know, if you can imagine somebody just put on the market an extraordinary version of illegal THC vapes, or even an extraordinary version of mango-flavored vapes. And they're all over the country illegally, and they're new, and they got huge fans. If that's true, then yeah, this could be big. If there's a new heroin dealer in town, and they've got a bad batch of heroin, and they're taking over, you know, killing off all the other heroin dealers, then pretty soon that bad batch of heroin is dominating the market, and you're getting a lot of people who are getting sick from that bad batch of heroin. So if there's a bad batch of illegal vapes that is taking over the U.S. market, that would begin to explain why it's happening in the U.S. and it doesn't seem to be happening anywhere else in the world. There are plenty of other places where people vape. I've been traveling around the world, and everywhere I go, I see people vaping. So it's not like this illness seems to be happening only in the U.S. They had one case, I think, in Canada. So all right, only in North America. Is there some illicit vape product that's big in North America and brand new that could account for this? My intuition is that the answer is no. But if the answer is yes, or if the answer is going to be yes, then yeah, it could get big. I mean, if this is, you know, an oil that shouldn't be inhaled, that's being added to what is quickly becoming the most popular illegal vape flavor, then it could be the tip of an iceberg. Are you with me?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's...
Now, the main reason for thinking that's not true is CDC keeps saying, you know, it's dozens of different products, it's hundreds of different products, we can't put our finger on what it is. And, you know, they've long had their finger on what it isn't. They could have said very early on, it's not commercial jewels that are being used, you know, straight from the package undoctored. They've got to know that. And they prefer not to say that because they're using it as a teachable moment against vaping. But if you take their word for it that, you know, they know what it isn't and they don't want to say so, but they really don't know what it is. If they don't know what it is, it can't be one big product. And if it's not one big product, it can't be the tip of the iceberg.
Well, that gets to, you know, the other big health scare that everybody is talking about, which is the Triple E. I think that's the first thing that's gotten people to stop talking about vaping. And there, it's also a very small number, really tiny number of people who've been affected. And I think that the fear is that it might somehow explode. And because Triple E has been around before and come and go, are there reasons to think it's very unlikely to be this thing that will be attacking millions of people?
I mean, I don't know enough about Triple E, but it's an infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike these lung injuries from vaping something, this is an infectious disease, and it's always a possibility with an infectious disease that what was rare can become common. You know, and whatever kept Triple E from, you know, I mean, you know, it's apparently quite dangerous to horses, and horses are vaccinated against it. But whatever kept it from spreading to people very often, is it possible that barrier is getting weaker, and that barrier is falling, and that, you know, getting Triple E will become something common in the same way that, you know, whatever, Lyme disease has become common, That's, of course, it's a different kind of disease altogether. But you know, if infectious diseases can go from rare to common. I mean, you have to know why they're rare, what's keeping them from being common, and then look very hard and see if the barriers that are keeping that particular disease from becoming common fall up, or are in process of falling. I don't know, and I don't know nearly enough to know whether they already know that happened, they're wondering that that might have happened, or they know perfectly well that hasn't happened.
Yeah, I know there's
in the absence of anyone saying the barriers have fallen, oh my God, Triple E is going to become common. And they're not saying that, you know, I mean, at least the stories I've read are not saying Triple E is, you know, which used to be rare, is going to be common because. You know, I you know, I mean, I've only read mainstream media, but I'm not reading anything that says that. In the absence of anything saying that, no, it's a blip.
It's a blip. I guess then the question is right. Who's right? People that are okay with enjoying these last nice days on the East Coast and going outside, or people that are shutting their doors and staying in because they're so terrified of this?
Yeah, I think it's a blip, and you know, and why are they making a big deal out of it? I think reporters are making a big deal out of it because it's an interesting story to cover. It's fun to cover, and I don't know that public health is making a big deal out of it. I mean, unlike the way that CDC and FDA and others, you know, actively encouraged everybody to think these lung illnesses are a big deal. I think they're just responding to questions about Triple E. Or at least I don't have the same feel that they're trying to scare people about it.
Okay, I know. I got some phone call from the government in Rhode Island warning that they're going to spray the whole state, so which is a response, and it because of Triple E that we should be aware that there will be government people mosquito spraying all over the state.
I don't know enough, but that, they may be using that as an excuse. I mean, New York City sprayed the hell out of, you know, did a lot of mosquito spraying that they claimed was because of Zika. And they knew perfectly well that they had no autochthonous transmission of Zika in New York City. They were worried about West Nile virus. But they thought if they said West Nile virus, the anti-spraying people would raise hell. But if they said Zika, they'd get away with spraying against West Nile virus.
I see. That
so
is...
So it may well be that Rhode Island has good reasons to spray, and equine encephalitis is not one of them, or is not the major one. But since it's in the news, it's an excuse to spray.
That's an interesting, it just struck me that, I don't know, maybe two people have died in the whole state, and that spraying everything seemed like an extreme response to this, but at the same time, if they did have other diseases they were worried about, and this one was the one that had caught the public imagination, I could see how they might want to tell us that this is the reason they're spraying, and not West Nile or other mosquito-borne diseases.
Yeah, which is dishonest, but dishonest in a good cause. It's a less horrible kind of dishonesty, in my judgment, than what they're doing with vaping. Zika's a nice example. When, you know, after the Zika scare was over and the U.S. had spent millions of dollars theoretically protecting us against Zika, although, you know, as you may remember, transmission of Zika in the continental United States was trivial. There was, you know, there were a handful of cases in Florida and an even smaller handful of cases in Texas, and a huge number of cases in Puerto Rico, which is, of course, not the continental United States. But Puerto Rico had a big Zika problem, and Texas and Florida had tiny Zika problems, and nobody else had any Zika problem.
Right.
In terms of autochthonous transmission. So, you know, after spending millions of federal dollars much of it on spraying that might have been useful, but not useful against Zika because there wasn't any Zika to prevent. In order to justify the expenditure, the CDC put out data that I found extremely amusing on how serious Zika was in Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And they put Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico together so that they could make it look like Texas and Florida had a serious problem.
Oh, even though it was not in the same league with the problem in Puerto Rico, by lumping them together. Interesting.
That's right.
Yeah, very interesting. That's right. Interesting.
Virtually all the Zika they had was in Puerto Rico, but you know they couldn't use Puerto Rico to justify spending a fortune in the continental U.S. So they said, well, we had to spray all over the U.S. because we had this big problem in Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico. And they made Puerto Rico sound like an afterthought, whereas, in fact, Puerto Rico was the 800-pound gorilla.
Interesting. Yeah. So I had another, this is on a different topic, a little off the beaten track, but I'm also interested in writing something about climate change, given the summit and all the interest in, you know, it's just... It's intriguing to me because I've been writing about climate change for so many years that it seems like this is the first time that there's been really, a large-scale public fear of climate change, of global warming. And I wondered if that's just because people, when it was just a forecast, people can't get motivated to worry about it. But now that we're starting to see effects in our own country, that people are finally motivated, or do you think there's some other reason that people have really turned around? I mean, 10 years ago, the public opinion was very divided. There wasn't this kind of concerted effort on the part of younger people to get something to happen.
I think two things have happened. The first thing that's happened is there are what at least can be interpreted as effects of climate change happening in the here and now. So it's not someday there will be no polar bears, or someday, Pacific Islands will be inundated. It's look at all these hurricanes we're having in the United States and we had the hottest summer. Or whatever, I don't remember the number, 7 of the 10 hottest summers in the U.S. ever were in the last 10 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
So people have a sense that it's not a problem for their grandchildren to worry about. It's a here and now problem. That's certainly one of the things that has happened. Another of the things that have, I'm inclined to think that the fact that mainstream politicians, especially obviously Democratic politicians, are now voicing eschatological kinds of thoughts, or saying, things like, we've got 12 years and to save the planet.
Yes.
If we don't save the planet in the next 12 years, it's going to be too late. I absolutely promise you that after 12 years, they will not say it's too late.
There's an interesting story in The New Yorker by Jonathan Franzen, of all people, saying, well, it's already too late. And, of course, that generated a lot of outrage.
It's already too late, but politicians are never going to... I mean, there's a long history of experts saying, if we don't do X pretty soon, it'll be too late.
Yes.
And then we, I can remember working for the freeze and arguing the freeze. You remember the nuclear freeze, or are you too young?
Nuclear winter, which is,
without going into ancient history, you say if we don't take action now, we're all doomed. And mm-hmm. then we don't take action. And the organization does not disband on the grounds that we're all doomed. They just find something else to say.
Right.
If we don't take action, we're all doomed.
Right. But it does seem like years.
I think the predictions of doom are part of what's going on,
mm-hmm.
Coming from mainstream politicians. I think the Green New Deal is a big piece of it, because it's really the first time that there has been an agenda for what to do about it.
Right.
That was coherent and had a label and had sponsors. And whether you think that the Green New Deal makes sense or you think it doesn't, and whether you think, you know, unilateral action on the part of the United States makes sense, or you think that everybody else is doing it and we don't have to lead because we're actually following. I mean, there are all kinds of sort of subsidiary debates. But I think you're right. At least at the moment, it's a high priority concern for large numbers of people. Things become a priority concern, and they don't necessarily last as a priority concern. I mean, you know, immigration is now a high priority concern for a large number of Americans.
Yeah.
Almost nobody was the least bit interested in immigration, and suddenly the right thinks the most important thing to do is to close the border, and the left thinks the most important thing to do is to open the border. And neither of them thought that was terribly important a decade ago.
Right. Yes, it's fascinating how that can.
Who knows how long climate change is going to have its moment in the sun, if you don't mind that. But right now, climate change has its moment in the sun, and I'm not sure why, and I'm not sure whether it'll last, and I'm not sure if I were hired to advise, you know, climate change activists on what to do with this teachable moment, what I would advise them to do. Although I think I would advise them to focus much more on adaptation and much less on mitigation.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, you brought up an important point that I thought it was like 11 years that the politicians are, that that's a very, something people can get their heads around, and in a way it's something people can get their heads around better than saying we have to limit our emissions to so many gigatons, we can only burn so much more coal, or we can only do, that's a very abstract thing, but to say we have to fix this problem in 11 years is not so abstract, and it seems like that has really lit a fire under a lot of young people, at least for now. Yes. At least for the time being. Yeah, and also an interesting observation on immigration, that you're right that it was sort of a non-issue a few years ago, even though there were problems. And now you have this. It's become top of the agenda with each political faction advocating the opposite solution. So that
the fact that immigration could rise from nothing to the top issue for both sides suggests that, you don't know how long climate change is going to be, one of the top issues facing the country. Maybe it remains that, and maybe it doesn't. But it's real important to figure out how to use that moment wisely. And I don't have a sense that they're focused well on how to use that moment wisely.
Interesting. Great. Well, thank you. I will let you go. This has been.